Why have people become so hateful toward their fellow man? Is there a biblical answer for the rise in violence and dissent across the world that we're seeing play out right now? As a part of Defender Publishing's Fall 2022 virtual conference, Dr. Thomas Horn presented a special report entitled The Angel of Death versus the Gift of Life. Today, we continue part two of this special presentation where Dr. Horn further explores the connection between violence, the angel of death, the end times, and how this violence goes against God's original design for humanity. What is the Lucifer effect? Find out right now.
Given that Jesus said in Matthew 24:37 that the end times would witness a return to the activity that happened when Nephilim first walked the earth, and that in fact is defined in the Old Testament as the earth being filled with violence, such as we see ourselves moving toward today. The Watchers set out not only to create them, but to genetically modify all creation, animals, humans, plants, according to the ancient texts. So is it possible that we have entered a reprise of the days of Noah, in which a genetic hazard could be, or already is, being unleashed that might result in a global pandemic, a Nephilim virus that would also play a role in epigenetics and perhaps even influence the behavior of a generation that will serve under Antichrist? There are numerous scenarios, all based on real science, that envision that an event could, in effect, modify epigenetics worldwide, and thus, hypothetically, the mind and makeup of all but those who would be protected by God. In theory, that might suddenly, effectively, diminish the ability of the sufferers to feel empathy towards others. So this brings me to my next little point, having to do with Stanford and the Lucifer effect. This is another fascinating connection, I think, to entertaining the angel of death's whispers, perhaps unknown to some readers, is this most notorious experiment that took place in America more than 40 years ago, commonly referred to today as the Stanford Prison Experiment. And it basically was this. In 1971, a group of student recruits participated in a study at Stanford University, where they were instructed to act out roles of detainees and guards in a makeshift prison in the basement of the school. Now, what resulted in the test was unexpected and immediate breakdown in normative social behavior that illustrated such astonishing cruelty on the part of the participants that it had to quickly be shut down, leading the organizer and the director, Professor Philip Zimbardo, to embark on a larger quest of discovery regarding how the majority of us can be seduced into behaving in ways totally atypical of what we believe that we are. Now, the program graphically illustrated that, given the right set of circumstances, a majority of people are capable of monstrous inhumanity against others. The Wikipedia entry on the Stanford Prison Experiments explains what happened. Quote, participants were recruited and told they would participate in a two-week prison simulation. Out of 70 respondents, Zimbardo and his team selected the 24 males whom they deemed to be the most psychologically stable and healthy. These participants were predominantly white and middle class. The group was intentionally selected to exclude those with criminal backgrounds, psychological impairments, medical problems, and so on. They all agreed to participate in the 7 to 14 day period and received $15 per day, roughly equivalent to about $100 per day in our current climate. The experiment was conducted in the basement of Jordan Hall, Stanford Psychological Building. 12 of the 24 participants were assigned the role of prisoners, 9 plus 3 alternates, while the other 12 were assigned the role of guard, also 9 plus 3 alternates. Zimbardo took on the role of the superintendent, and an undergraduate research assistant the role of the warden. Zimbardo designed the experiment in order to induce disorientation, depersonalization, and de-individualization in the participants. The researchers held an orientation session for the guards the day before the experiment, during which they were instructed not to physically harm the prisoners. In the footage of the study, Zimbardo can be seen talking to the guards, saying this, quote, "You can create in the prisoners feelings of boredom, a sense of fear to some degree. You can create a notion of arbitrariness, that their life is totally controlled by us, by the system, you, me. They'll have no privacy. We're going to take away their individuality in various ways. In general, what all this leads to is a sense of powerlessness. That is, in the situation, we'll have all the power and they will have none," end quote. The researchers provided the guards with wooden batons to establish their status, clothing similar to that of an actual prison guard, khaki shirts and pants from a local military surplus store, and mirrored sunglasses to prevent eye contact. Prisoners wore uncomfortable, ill-fitting smocks and stocking caps, as well as a chain around one ankle. Guards were instructed to call prisoners by their assigned numbers sewn on their uniforms instead of by their names. The prisoners were arrested at their homes and charged with armed robbery. The local Palo Alto Police Department assisted Zimbardo with the arrests and conducted full booking procedures on the prisoners, which included fingerprinting and taking mugshots. They were then transported to the mock prison from the police station, where they were strip-searched and given their new identities. The small mock prison cells were set up to hold three prisoners each. There was a small space for the prison yard, solitary confinement, and a bigger room across from the prisoners for the guards and warden. The prisoners were to stay in their cells all day and night until the end of the study. The guards worked in teams of 3, 4, 8-hour shifts. The guards did not have to stay on the site after their shift. Now, after a relatively uneventful first day, on the second day, the prisoners in cell one blockaded their cell door with their beds and took off their stocking caps, refusing to come out or to follow the guards' instructions. Guards from other shifts volunteered to work extra hours to assist in subduing the revolt, and subsequently attacked the prisoners with fire extinguishers without being supervised by the research staff. Finding that handling 9 cellmates with only 3 guards per shift was challenging, one of the guards suggested that they use psychological tactics to control them. So they set up a privilege cell in which prisoners who were not involved in the riot were treated with special rewards, such as higher quality meals. The privileged inmates chose not to eat the meals in order to stay uniform with their fellow prisoners. After only 36 hours, one prisoner began to act crazy, as Zimbardo described, and then he began to act crazy, to scream, to curse, to go into a rage that seemed out of control. It took quite a while before we became convinced that he was actually suffering and that we had to release him, said Zimbardo at the time. Guards forced the prisoners to repeat their assigned numbers to reinforce the idea that this was their new identity. Guards soon used these prisoner counts to harass the prisoners, using physical punishment such as protracted exercise for errors in the prison count. Sanitary conditions declined rapidly, exasperated by the guards' refusal to allow some prisoners to urinate or to defecate anywhere but in a bucket placed in their cell. Then as punishment, the guards would not let the prisoners empty the sanitation bucket. Mattresses were a valued item to the prison, so the guards would punish prisoners by removing their mattresses and leaving them to sleep on the concrete. Some prisoners were forced to be naked as a method of degradation. Several guards became increasingly cruel as the experiment continued. Experimenters reported that approximately 1/3 of the guards exhibited genuine sadistic tendencies, doing things that I'm not going to mention here, by the way, but of a sexual nature. Most of the guards were upset when the experiment concluded after only 6 days. Zimbardo argued that the prisoners had internalized their roles since, even though some had stated that they would accept parole, even if it would mean forfeiting their pay, they did not quit when their parole applications were all denied. So Zimbardo argued they had no reason for continued participation in the experiment after having lost all monetary compensation, and yet they did anyway because they had internalized the prisoner identity mechanism. Prisoner number 416, a newly admitted standby prisoner, expressed concern over the treatment of the other prisoners. The guards responded with more abuse. When he refused to eat his sausages, saying he was on a hunger strike, guards confined him to solitary confinement, which was a dark closet. The guards then instructed the other prisoners to repeatedly punch on the floor while shouting at 416. The guard stated that he would be released from solitary confinement only if the prisoners gave up their blankets and slept on their blue mattresses, which all but one refused to do. Zimbardo aborted the experiment early when Christina Mashlak, a graduate student in psychology, whom he was dating and then later married, objected to the conditions of the prison after she was introduced to the experiment to conduct interviews. Zimbardo noted that of more than 50 people who had observed the experiment, Mashlak was the only one who questioned its morality after only 6 days of a planned 2 weeks. Duration, the Stanford Prison experiment was discontinued. Following the Stanford Prison experiment, Zimbardo wanted to continue his research into the dark side of human psychology to decipher under what conditions it can be uncaged. His next big opportunity came nearly 2 decades ago, in April of 2004. He was on a business trip to Washington, D.C., when he saw the American television show 60 Minutes airing images taken from the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq of the naked detainees there being forced to simulate sex acts in front of mocking U.S. soldiers. Other prisoners were unclothed and made to lie atop each other. A female soldier was seen leading a naked Iraqi around like a dog, complete with leash and collar. And electric wires were attached to a hooded inmate who was balancing on a small box. Later, it was learned that this type of torture had become sexualized and included examples of a male prisoner being sodomized by a guard using a chemical light and a female prisoner being raped. Now, while Americans were aghast at the images and information many of you will recall coming out at that time, Zimbardo had seen this sadism before, right there at Stanford University years earlier, where his undergraduates had forced fellow students to simulate sodomy, among other things. Although Zimbardo's guards knew their classmates had actually done nothing to deserve the maltreatment, he later wrote, quote, "Some were transformed into perpetrators of evil," end quote, illustrating that, quote, "most of us can undergo significant character transformations when we are caught up in the crucible of social forces." Remind you of today? In January 2008, Random House published Zimbardo's impressive yet chilling study on the subject in a book actually titled The Lucifer Effect: Understanding How Good People Turn Evil. In that book, Zimbardo, who was called as an expert psychologist to testify during the trial of the Abu Ghraib guards, dismantled what happened at that military facility, while also reflecting on his earlier Stanford experiment, to conclude that wherever conditions allow for what he calls de-individualization, the foundations for the towers of evil are laid, and a line between good and evil can be crossed in nearly any heart. Interestingly, Zimbardo actually drew parallels between his findings and the biblical story of the fall of that once powerful angel named Lucifer. Here's what he wrote, quote, "According to various scenarios of early Christian church fathers from Cyprus, Armenia, Greece, and France, Lucifer was God's favorite angel. His sin and the origin of his transformation into the devil stems from his envy of man and disobedience to God. Apparently, a cosmic battle ensued in which Lucifer and the fallen angels were cast out of heaven into hell. Lucifer is transformed into Satan, the devil, following his fall from grace. Thus, the Lucifer effect represents this most extreme transformation imaginable from God's favorite, in this case an angel, into the devil. My work, he says, has focused on lesser transformations of human character, not as dramatic as this one, but in which ordinary, even good people, begin to engage in bad deeds for a short time or longer that qualify as evil. Zimbardo has gone on to describe how, given the right situational conditions, ordinary persons can be transformed from good to evil and will proceed to engage in malevolent activity, even to the point of setting aside personal attributes of morality, compassion, or sense of justice and fair play. Of course, what Zimbardo's research reflects was revealed beforehand in the Bible. Again, going a bit off subject, given these facts about fallen human nature, is it much of a stretch to imagine the role that the Lucifer effect is going to play in this current hour leading up to the reign of Antichrist and his religious followers? Now let me get to this point. Who is really behind Murder's Voice?
Ladies and gentlemen, we have to take a very quick break, but when we return, Dr. Thomas Horn will lift the veil behind just who might be the actual voice of murder.
There exists an ancient prophecy about a great burning mountain that falls from the sky, bringing devastation to the world. And the signs of its coming have now appeared.
It's racing toward our planet at this very moment. It cannot be stopped, and it's carrying the secret of America's, the world's, and your tomorrow.
When I shared what God had revealed to me about a worldwide destruction set for only a few years from now, some people responded with disbelief, and some are terrified. Revelation 8 is unfolding as we speak, bringing not only wanton destruction, but also an ancient messenger heralding the arrival of the Great Tribulation period, just before the second coming of Jesus Christ. A prophesied aeon that some people call the Great Tribulation period. Whether they want it or not, all of those on earth at this time are going to be forced to heed the warning of the messenger.
In the new documentary film, Ragnarok, Humanity's Last Stand, visionary filmmaker Josh Peck takes you on a journey through the ancient prophecy from the Book of Revelation about a burning mountain that falls from the sky, bringing devastation to the world, and what scientists and NASA have to say about it. In this explosive documentary film, you will learn how the Wormwood Prophecy connects to our modern age, whether the coming asteroid Apophis could be the harbinger of destruction, the science, history, and prophecies surrounding asteroid impact, Dr. Thomas Horn's full in-time vision of destruction, what NASA is saying about Apophis, and what we can do about this threat. But that's not all. We're also including Ragnarok, Mountains of Judgment, where you will take a deep dive into the prophecy and science behind asteroids, and how this relates to the coming space rock named after the Egyptian god of chaos, Apophis. Sold separately, these items hold a retail value of over $75. Yours now for your donation of only $35 plus shipping and handling. So uncover the prophecies of destruction and learn the mysteries of the last days. This collection is available only through Skywatch TV, so don't delay. Available now at SkywatchTVStore.com. Order now or call 1-844-750-4985.
When one recalls the horrific rituals of the ancient followers of the god Dionysus, it's easy to believe that demonic possession actually occurred and modified the mental state of normal persons, changing them into murderers even in recent years. A Christian should find that idea that demons can turn otherwise normal people into killers if they give their minds over to evil supernaturalism plausible, as it seems that the Hebrews certainly considered Hades, or the Greek god of the underworld, to be equal with hell and or the devil. Many ancient writers likewise saw no difference between Hades, in this sense the devil, and Dionysus. In fact, Euripides again echoed that sentiment in the Hecuba, and he referred to the followers of Dionysus as the Bacchants of Hades. In Syracuse, Dionysus was known as Dionysus Morikos, the Dark One, a fiendish creature, roughly equivalent to the biblical Satan, who wore goat skins and he dwelt in the regions of the underworld. In the scholarly book Dionysus Myth and Cult, Walter F. Otto connected Dionysus with the prince of the underworld as well. He wrote, quote, "The similarity and relationship which Dionysus has with the prince of the underworld, and this is revealed by a large number of comparisons, is not only confirmed by an authority of the first rank, but he says the two deities are actually the same. Heraclitus says Hades and Dionysus, for whom they go mad in rage, are one and the same." Even the Hebrew prophet Ezekiel, I believe, condemned the mind-altering madness of Dionysus as inherently satanic. He spoke of the magic bands, or the kasetot in Hebrew, of the bacchae, which, as in the omophagia, were used to mesmerize the minds of men. So where the King James Version says, "Wherefore, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I am against your pillows, wherewith ye there hunt the souls to make them fly, and I will tear them from your arms and let those souls go, even the souls that you hunt to make them fly," Ezekiel 13:20. So the kasetot, or magic armband, were used in connection with a container called the kist, K-I-S-T-E. And wherever the kist is inscribed on sarcophagi or on bacchic scenes, it's depicted as a sacred vessel, a mind prison, where a snake is peering through an open lid. Now, how this magic worked and in what way a mind was imprisoned remains a mystery. We don't know. But Pan, the half-man, half-goat god, who was later relegated to devildom, is sometimes pictured as kicking the lid open and letting the snake or the mind out. This mysterious imagery of Pan, the serpents, the imprisoned minds, and the magic kasetot and kist have never been adequately explained by any available authority, and the interpretation of them as a method of mind control is subject to ongoing scrutiny. But since the prophet Ezekiel spoke of the efforts of the bacchae to mystically imprison the minds of men through the magic bands of Dionysus, and since Pan was most beloved of Dionysus because of his pandemonium, which is all the devils, which struck sudden panic in the hearts of men and beast, and as the serpent was universally accepted by the Hebrews as a symbol of occult devotion, I think that it can easily be surmised that the iconography of Dionysus represented the most tenacious effort on the part of the bacchae to fulfill the psychological whims of evil supernaturalism. I think that's still happening today. I think right now there is a contest for the mind of a generation that is pushing them towards violence and murder. Now, in Acts 17:34, though, we learn something very important to this presentation. We read of the conversion of Dionysius the Areopagite, and this is significant because having the name Dionysius probably meant that the parents were devotees of Dionysus, and therefore the child was predestined, if you will, to be a follower of the god. He may have also been under a mind-altering kasetot spell. And yet, the powers of that darkness lost control over Dionysius' mind when he accepted the gospel of Jesus Christ. Jesus liberated him, like he did the lunatics of Matthew 4:24 and 17:15. When Jesus touched the wild man, he left him, it says, quote, "sitting and clothed and in his right mind," Mark 5:15. I'm here to tell you that Jesus is still in the mind healing business, and testimonies abound of people whose minds have been released from murderous madness into his marvelous light. You could, as I did when interviewing him for our best-selling book, Redeemed Unredeemable, ask David Berkowitz about that, the former Son of Sam killer. David received Christ on the prison floor and told me, he said, when I finished talking to God, I got up, my mind seemed to flood with a sense of peace. I knew from that moment that Jesus Christ heard me. I sensed in my heart that I was forgiven and that I was now free, end quote. Ted Bundy pleaded for an interview with Dr. James Dobson prior to his court-ordered date with Destiny. Bundy appeared genuinely sorrowful on a videotaped interview and acknowledged the murderous, horrific effects of his past sinful thinking. He asked Jesus to forgive him. You might recall Carla Faye Tucker. She was the first woman executed in the state of Texas in 135 years. She testified, however, of the mind-altering effect of drugs, that it was a gateway, that it opened her mind to the influence of evil supernaturalism. On the eve of her execution, CBN reporter Kathy Shero asked Carla, she said, "Why do you agree to talk to the media regardless of why they are coming to you?" And Carla's response was this. She said, quote, "God has given me a great big open door to share the love of Jesus, and I'm going to do it. My heart has been to share with the world the love that he poured out into me, the forgiveness, the mercy, the way that he can change a life. Now, look, I get it. Most of us view such deathbed conversions with skepticism. Last-minute loyalties attributed to our Savior in the midnight hour most often bring scoffing. And yet, we read of the criminal on the cross next to Jesus and see the Lord honoring his plea for forgiveness in Luke 23, 42 through 43. Jesus extended mercy and offered eternal fellowship to every repentant soul. Perhaps Kip Kinkle, who actually targeted Christians for execution, will discover what David Berkowitz says he has, that the saving power of Jesus Christ is mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ, 2 Corinthians 10:4 through 5. Jeffrey Weiss, the angel of death, appears to have been lost from that idea. And one final thought. If you too have been listening to this dark angelic influence, whether through a fascination with creatures of the night, occult practices, satanic symbolism, rebellion like we see on the streets today, or even murderous contemplation, I want to invite you to deliverance, healing, the greatest life, forgiveness through Jesus Christ. I want to invite you to ask him to come into your heart, to cleanse your mind, to forgive you, and to be your Savior. As Philippians 4:8 says, "Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on those things."